All right, and welcome to another episode of Bakari Sellers Podcast. Shout out to everyone who has voted in the NAACP Image Awards. We're happy to be nominated for having the most amazing podcast ever or something like that. That may not be the category, but you'll find it. Click, vote, do all of those things. And shout out to the NAACP Image Awards. Today, keeping with our theme of just having brilliant, smart people on this show, we try to have people on here who can leave us with something more than what we came to the show with. We have Jonquillen Hill. How are you today?
I'm good. Happy to be here.
Yeah, for sure. So my show is unique because we ask all of our guests the same first question, which is to walk us through your career, talk about your career arc. And you've done quite a bit since finishing Howard. Can you walk us through each one of your career stops since Howard and the work that you do now at Vox?
Yeah. So after graduating from Howard, I stayed in D.C. And the first job I got after college was as a desk assistant at the NBC Washington Bureau. So, you know, entry level, working on the assignment desk, seeing how sort of all the pieces work together. After that, I was a producer for what at the time was Time Warner Cable News, but now is Spectrum with New York One. So, you know, producing and doing a lot of behind the scenes work for coverage about Texas, the Texas delegation, the North Carolina delegation, the New York congressional delegation, and kind of seeing, you know, how the sausage is made in the day to day. After that, I was at NPR on the elections desk in 2016, which that was a wild
chaos.
Ride.
That sounds like chaos.
It was nothing. I mean, as I'm sure you and your listeners know, nothing went as planned. And that taught me a lot as well. After that, I was a producer on 1A, out of WAMU for about 5 years, worked as an associate producer, worked my way up to producer, took a break for a while to do a podcast called Through the Cracks, which is about the first season was about the disappearance of Relisha Rudd, who was an 8-year-old who disappeared from a homeless shelter in D.C. back in 2014. To this day has not been found. And so it was less of a whodunit and more of a howdunit, just looking at the systems that failed her. And I think that was my first time really taking a look.
Is she still alive?
We don't know.
I mean, I'm talking to you.
Oh, well, it's so hard because I think part of me hopes that she is.
Yeah.
But I think realistically, no. And I remember talking to a former police officer and he was saying, honestly, like with what could have happened to her, it might be better if she might be more at peace if she's no longer with us versus if she is.
Yeah.
And it was a real look at homelessness and just childhood homelessness and how, you know, there are all these inflection points in people's lives and all it takes is sort of one instant for everything to change. And now I'm at Vox and I'm hosting The Weeds.
The Weeds, for people that may have never heard of Vox, what is it? And talk about your work at The Weeds.
Yeah. So Vox, typically, if you want to see something explained, we are the place you go to. Lots of in-depth analysis, lots of, okay, what's going on in the world? Can you explain it to me in very simple terms? So it's a mix of, you know, getting the basic information out to people, but also doing in-depth analysis. And so The Weeds is the policy podcast from Vox. And so it takes a deep dive into policies and different policies that touch people's lives.
I first of all, I think it's fascinating. And I think the work that Vox does is fascinating. And I like the fact that the platform is diversifying. Maybe that's the right word to use, not only with the people, but with the type of programming that it's doing. I want to dig into your latest project, though, Black Women And. What is it? And why did you think this project was necessary?
Yeah. So Black Women And is a 3-episode series we're doing about how policy impacts Black women in particular. And the way that I determine if a policy is effective or not is how it impacts the most marginalized people. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times that's Black women. An episode that we have coming up in particular stuck out to me. We're doing it on healthcare and this idea of weathering, this idea that Black people, part of the reason that we have such different health outcomes than a lot of our white counterparts is because of the impact of racism and stress on the body. And I first started thinking of this myself when last year I had surgery to remove my fibroids. And I was looking into it and I was just like, why is this happening to me? Why does this happen so much more often to Black women? And it just sort of, I just sort of went down a rabbit hole about how different policies are impacting us.
I mean, one of the things that I was kind of taken aback by or enamored by are the three topics that you chose: housing, marriage, and healthcare. First, why those three topics? Because I want to talk about each of these. And what's been the reception to this project?
Yeah, the reception has been really good. Although I will say sometimes people look at the statistics and are like, "Oh man, this is depressing. Like, I can't believe this." And I understand that gut reaction, but I think the flip side of that is that hopefully can inspire change. And the way I think of it is that statistics are not things that are static.
Yeah.
They can change. They change with our circumstances. They change with our policies. So there is an opportunity to change. As far as how we determine the topics, we really wanted something we try to do at the Weeds is really talk about what I call kitchen table topics. So things that
And
are
get in the weeds, which is why I listen to it. You make me smarter.
exactly like
Yes.
getting really like getting nerdy about
Correct.
everyday things that impact our lives. And so when we took a step back, we were like, okay. What impacts people most? Where you live, your partnerships, and your health. So we decided that this go round, like that would be a good step to hone on those three topics.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com. This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
So let's break this down. Housing. What are Black women experiencing on the housing market in your reporting? Like, how much are the challenges, like issues like affordability and the interest rate environment versus issues such as discrimination and appraisals versus the opportunities that the housing market presents to Black women as developers, realtors, and the like? So, what are you seeing in the overall?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting because going in that vein of the most marginalized, something that we really talk about a lot is evictions. So, according to Princeton's Eviction Lab, about 7.6 million Americans are threatened with eviction, face the threat of eviction every year. And a good chunk of those, a disproportional amount of those, are Black women, and in particular, Black women with children. And a lot of times we see, for various reasons, Black women are the people who are going to have the names on their lease for their family. They're going to be the person who's sort of, making sure everyone has a place to live. And if that's put in jeopardy, it also impacts health, it impacts their children, it impacts their partners, it impacts everything. We talk about sort of this concept of the Scarlet E, this idea that eviction for Black women is very similar. Eviction does to Black women what the prison industrial complex does to Black men, and that once you come in contact with it, it can forever change your life. Like, you, if you're evicted and it shows up, landlords won't want to rent to you. The same way, if you've been to prison, you will struggle to get a job. Like, it really is having a real impact on these families.
Yeah, we just had a young lady on from the current project talking about single Black moms and delving in and doing surveys on that demographic. You know, what policy implications did you take away from your reporting on housing that candidates and elected officials at all levels of government, Black, white, Democrat, or Republican, can do to improve the housing outcomes for Black women?
It's interesting because I think I, at the end of each episode, I ask each of the experts I talk to, you know, if you could wave a magic wand, what would your, you know, policy wish list be to fix this particular issue? And something that came up time and time again with each person was this idea of reparations. Like, this is a money issue.
It is.
And unfortunately, the political will for it is not there. One thing that could help with housing, we talked to Julia Craven about this, is just more affordable childcare. That's a major factor in all of this. Childcare is expensive. It's a major expense. And if you're trying to, you know, pay rent, pay a mortgage, and also pay for childcare, it's a lot for a family to handle.
I mean, it's, you think about reparations, you think about the fact that it's a money issue, and then, you know, the devastating effects that homelessness have on usually the primary caregiver in our community. And it just, it shows you why we end up where we end up many times over. I'm really interested in the marriage conversations because I'm just going to be quiet and listen on that one. What's the marriage landscape for Black women, both in your personal experience and from your reporting?
Oh, man. Well, personally, I can...
I'm going to sit back and just listen.
I could tell you about some conversations I have at brunch with my friends. It's been better. It's not the best it has been. And actually, the marriage rate has gone down. And the marriage rate has gone down, you know, for most demographics in the country. But for Black people in particular, there was a recent survey and the age they looked at was, you know, 40. Have you been married or ever been married by the age of 40? And I think the number for Black women that who had never been married was 48%, and the number for Black men was 51%. And so it's just it is an issue. And, you know, we talk about this in the episode because I start the episode asking the question, okay, why does it matter? Why is marriage such a big deal? And Diane Stewart, who's the Emory professor and also the author of Black Women, Black Love, who I speak to about it, it's the fact that marriage is a civil right and it's something, you know, that you should be able to have easy access to, but because of history and also because of current circumstances, there are systemic reasons that Black women, particularly Black women who want to partner with Black men, don't have the same access to getting married.
What does that look like in the future? What's the eyes? I mean, to the Black women who are listening to this as they're working out or going to work, after listening to, you know, your show and listening to The Weeds, should they have hope?
I think if you want to be married, you should be. I think you should be hopeful because the way I think about it, okay, if 48% of Black women have never been married, that means 52% have. Somebody has to be in that 2%. And girl, if you want it to be you, there is no reason that it won't be you. I also think, like I said before, numbers change, circumstances change. Like, if you want to see a shift in numbers, like, we can make it happen. We just gotta, you know, see what happens. And granted, we're not alone in this. So, you know, that's also a major factor as well. You know, the men are a factor.
Yeah, I'm about to say more.
Yeah, well, Black men tend to get married less than Black women, including, you know, as they move up, whether they're poor, middle class, or upper middle class. And so the reasons for barriers for poor folks often, you know, it'll be things like the prison industrial complex, lack of money, but that lack of wealth also impacts middle and upper middle class Black people who want to get married because marriage is no longer considered a cornerstone of adulthood where it's like, okay, I got married and now I'm moving on to adulthood. It's considered a capstone. So, you know, you go to college, you get the career, you maybe buy the house and then you say, okay, I'm ready to get married.
Is marriage still necessary for the American dream? Like for Black women, you know, for a long period of time, I'm presuming And I think that that is accurate, that we were all raised in this as millennials to believe that you get a job, you go to college, or you go to college, get a job, you get married, you have kids. Is that still the same today, or has that been kind of fractured? And there are new goalposts that have to be reached in
There are
attainment.
definitely new goalposts. Like, I think, a big accomplishment for some people might be, I paid off my student loans.
Yeah.
And
Shout out to my wife. Shout out to Ellen.
like that is a big check mark. And so now, and I think that's part of the changing landscape too. It's less of a check mark and more of, oh, do I want this? Do I desire this? And that can be difficult, especially when you consider the fact that, a lot of Black women out-earn Black men. A lot of Black women have more degrees than their male counterparts. And so it's also taking a look at marriage and saying, okay, well, what do we expect of partnership? Do we expect sort of like this patriarchal view where the man makes more and XYZ? Or are we thinking of it as more of a partnership? And Diane does a great job getting into that.
I want to hear your thoughts as an expert on the subject, because you are. I'm adorning you as an expert. We just watched Fonnie Willis yesterday, and you have this amazing. I'm assuming you watched it like the rest of
Oh yeah, I was
them.
clue I was
Group
I clocked
chat
in.
on fire, right?
The group chat, yes, correct.
Talk to me about just as you think about your reporting in this particular project, Black Women Anne. I want you to look at the way Fonnie was treated, how she talked about relationships, she talked about going through marriage, outside of marriage, this, and what you've learned from your project, and overlay that on what we saw yesterday with Fannie Willis. How do you analyze that? Or Fonnie Willis, excuse me.
Yeah, as it was happening, I couldn't help but think of, what was going on. Like you have like this high-powered, like successful Black woman dating. Like who is in her dating pool? Like who is around? And like that
Nathan,
definitely
some
being a
dude named
factor.
Nathan.
Yeah. Money coming up. Money is very much like an issue that comes
her
up.
habits of keeping cash, because a man ain't no plan. Sounds like something a Black dad told her, which we know
It's
she.
very it was very auntie coded, as I like to say. It was extremely auntie coded, where it's like always make sure, like if you go on a date, always make sure you have money, because if something goes left, you need to be able to pay and get out of there. Like that's not uncommon. And so it was very interesting
Let me just
sort of.
correct. That's not uncommon in our community.
That's true. And I forget that. I think that's a like and I think that's part of it too. You're hearing these conversations that are typically happen more internally, happen externally, and seeing the response to it can be a little like, oh,
It's
y'all don't do that.
jarring. It's jarring. First of all,
Yeah.
I was like, I saw her want to take the stand. I saw how she took the stand, and we know looks. And I saw that look like, oh yeah, it's that look like you about to get a spanking when you get home. That's how she took the stand. And she reacted the way that anybody, I think, with that's that nimble in the courtroom, that brilliant, would react if they were being accused of something like that. And then I just felt bad that she had to like delve into who she was sleeping with, when she was sleeping with them, why she was sleeping with them, and how she got to where she was going.
Yeah, and it's really interesting that I mean, it's different circumstances, but historically just the way that there has been sort of intervention in Black relationships, and that caused like a lot of the major systemic problems we see in the episode about eviction and also the episode about marriages, because there used to be something called the man in house rule. So if a woman and the substitute father rule. So if a woman had children and was in a relationship with a man and welfare or social workers came over and they saw evidence that the man might like stay there, or they had an inkling that she was staying at his place around maybe like one night a week, the state would take the benefits away, saying, oh, you're in a relationship with an able-bodied man, therefore you don't need government benefits. And so it really discouraged partnership, especially among poor people who couldn't make ends meet without the state benefits, because it's like, okay, the calculus just doesn't make sense. And that lasted until 1968, when the Supreme Court struck it down and said, okay, this is unconstitutional.
Well, man, you just educated me on that. That's why you're on this show, and that's why this show is so good. Let me talk to you. I gotta, you mentioned this a little bit earlier. Let's talk healthcare, which is the third topic you go into, specifically fibroids, which you brought up earlier. But I want to dig just a little deeper. I know about fibroids. My sister's a physician. I got a Black mama, wife, sister, and daughters. But why is this such an issue with Black women in particular? And from your reporting, what drives higher incidences for fibroids in Black women, and what are we doing about it?
Yeah, that's the wild part about fibroids is we don't know. We don't know what causes them. We don't know why Black women are more likely to experience them. There are lots of different, hypotheses. Some people think it's chemicals. I mean, we are right now, we're probably covered in microplastics just as we're speaking, just because that's the world we live in. Also, I got relaxers when I was a teenager.
Yep,
Maybe
you
that's a
did.
factor. That could
Yeah, I know you got them at least every Easter.
Oh, every six, I was every 6 weeks, I was in that chair. We did not play around with touch-ups growing up. My mom was like, "All right, I'm going to the hair salon. You coming too? Come on, let's get in the car." Like that. And, did that ritual lead to this? Who can say?
Yeah.
And
But
they're
what are we
just
doing about it is probably the most important. And any of the questions that you're asking when you're delving into these topics, I think. Nobody knows my number one political issue just by looking at me, but my number one political issue is African American female mortality because Ellen, people listen to the show, people know Ellen nearly died during childbirth. She spent the first 36 hours of our kid's life in ICU. And so my question is like, what are we doing about it?
Yeah, well, there is research, but it's very siloed right now, and that's one of the issues. And so it's this idea of, getting the research less siloed. Also, Dr. Uche Blackstock, who I talked to for the health episode, does a lot of work in health equity, and in particular, educating doctors on how to treat Black patients and how to do culturally competent care. And that's a major factor. At the end, too, she gives tips for Black women navigating the healthcare system. So, if you need to bring a friend to help advocate for you, do it. Bring a list of things you want to talk to the doctor about. Like having someone with you can be a major factor in things staying on track or things going left. Having someone there to advocate for you.
Look, I gotta ask this question because what did you learn from your reporting that you didn't already know about each of these topics? And this is the most important part. Like, and what do you want to do next? A follow-up series, a book, a TV show? Like, I feel like you can't stop with this because it's good and necessary. And you gotta do something else with this great reporting. So what's next?
Okay, as far as what I learned, the man in house policy, that was new to me. That
Yeah,
was something
you
that
just
I
educated.
did not realize was, and it's so like I think my reaction when I first read about it was, wow, you are all up in my business. That's crazy. Like just it's really wild. Also, I'd always been interested in epigenetics before this health episode, which is this idea that trauma can change your DNA. And so if you look at the DNA of Black people in the US, like it's some will be shorter just because of the stress that we experience. Or one fact I was told was that when a Black immigrant moves to America, their health is on par with white Americans. 1 to 2 generations in, the health of that person, that family will decline to the state of Black Americans who were born here and have lived here for generations. So, something about this country is having a real impact on our health. As far as what's next, I would love to keep this series going. I didn't think about a book, but I've always wanted to get to writing. So, maybe that's the next step.
I think that is the next step. What other projects are you working on that you can talk about? And how can we find this series, Black Women and?
Yeah, so we're working on some really cool episodes of The Weeds this election year. We had an episode not too long ago about economic fan fiction. Just like we have to admit to ourselves, election years are not always about policy, but if they were, what would we talk about? Like what are the conversations we want to have and what are the policies we want to see happen, and having those conversations. So we're going to keep writing some fan fiction about the world we want to see.
That's good. John Quinlan Hill, thank you so much for joining the Bakari Sellers podcast. This was fun. We got to do it again.
Yes. Thank you so much.